They were fast and irregular, like a pair of trapped moths. "Tell me it isn't," he said. Still confounded, the old librarian just held out the request form. Laszlo took it. He read it. His hands shook. It was what he thought. In Nero's bold, sweeping script was written, "The Complete Works of Laszlo Strange." Master Hurricane asked, in utter mystification, "What in the world could Thion Nero want with your books?" Chapter 4. The Bastard God of Fortune. The Alchemist and the Librarian. They couldn't have been more different. As though Shrez, the Bastard God of Fortune, had stood them side by side and divided his basket of gifts between them. Every gift to Thion Nero, one by one, until the very last, which he dropped in the dirt at Laszlo's feet. "Make what you can of that," he might have said, if there were such a god, and he was feeling spiteful. To Thion Nero, birth, wealth, privilege, looks, charm, brilliance. And to Laszlo Strange, to pick up and dust off, the one thing left over, honor. It might have been better for him if Nero got that one too. Like Laszlo, Thion Nero was born during the war. But war, like fortune, doesn't touch all folk with the same hand. He grew up in his father's castle, far from the sight and smell of suffering, much less the experience of it. On the same day that a grey and nameless infant was plunked on a cart bound for Zeminin Abbey, a golden one was christened Thion, after the warrior saint who drove the barbarians out of Zosma, in a lavish ceremony attended by half the court. He was a clever, beautiful child, and though his elder brother would inherit the title and lands, he claimed all else. Love, attention, laughter, praise. And he claimed it loudly. If Laszlo was a silent baby, harshly raised by resentful monks, Thion was a small, charming tyrant who demanded everything and was given even more. Laszlo slept in a barracks of boys, went to bed hungry, and woke up cold. Thion's boyhood bed was shaped like a war brig, complete with real sails and riggings, and even miniature cannons, so heavy it took the strength of two maids to rock him to sleep. His hair was of such an astonishing colour, as the sun in frescoes, where you might stare at it without burning out your eyes, that it was allowed to grow long, though this was not the fashion for boys. It was only cut on his 9th birthday, to be woven into an elaborate neckpiece for his godmother, the queen. She wore it, and, to the dismay of goldsmiths, spawned a fashion for human hair jewellery, though none of the imitations could compare with the original in brilliance. Thion's nickname, the Golden Godson, was with him from his christening, and perhaps it ordained his path. Names have power, and he was, from infancy, associated with gold. It was fitting, then, that when he entered the university, he made his place in the College of Alchemy. What was alchemy? It was metallurgy wrapped in mysticism, the pursuit of the spiritual by way of the material. The great and noble effort to master the elements in order to achieve purity, perfection, and divinity. Oh, and gold. Let's not forget gold. Kings wanted it. Alchemists promised it, had been promising it for centuries. And if they achieved purity and perfection in anything, it was the purity and perfection of their failure to produce it. Thion, 13 years old and sharp as the point of a viper's fang, had looked around him at the cryptic rituals and philosophies, and seen it all as obfuscation, cooked up to excuse that failure. "Look how complicated this is," alchemists said, even as they made it so. Everything was outlandish. Initiates were required to swear an oath upon an emerald, said to have been pried from the brow of a fallen angel. And when presented with this artifact, Thion laughed. He refused to swear on it, and flat refused to study the esoteric texts, which he called the consolation of would-be wizards cursed to live in a world without magic.
"You, young man, have the soul of a blacksmith,"
the master of alchemy told him in a cold rage.
"Better than the soul of a charlatan,"
Thion shot back.
"I would sooner swear an oath on an anvil and do honest work than dupe the world with make-believe."
And so it was that the golden godson swore his oath on a blacksmith's anvil, instead of the angel's emerald. Anyone else would have been expelled, but he had the queen's favor. And so the old guard had no choice but to stand aside and let him do his own work in his own way. He cared only for the material side of things, the nature of elements, the essence and mutability of matter. He was ambitious, meticulous, and intuitive. Fire, water, and air yielded up secrets to him. Minerals revealed their hidden properties. And at 15, to the deep dismay of the would-be wizards, he performed the first transmutation in Western history. Not gold, alas, but lead into bismuth, and did so, as he said, without recourse to spirits or spells. It was a triumph, for which he was rewarded by his godmother with a laboratory of his own. It took over the grand old church at the Great Library, and no expense was spared. The queen dubbed it the Chrysoposium, from Chrysopoeia, the transmutation of base metal into gold, and she wore her necklace of his hair when she came to present it to him. They walked arm in arm in matching gold, his on his head, hers on her neck, and soldiers marched behind them, clad in gold surcoats commissioned for the occasion. Laszlo stood in the crowd that day, awed by the spectacle, and by the brilliant golden boy who had always seemed to him like a character from a story. A young hero blessed by fortune, rising to take his place in the world. That was what everyone saw, like an audience at the theatre, blithely unaware that backstage the actors were playing out a darker drama, as Laszlo was to discover. It was about a year after that. He was 16, and he was taking the bypass through the tomb walk one evening, when he heard a voice as hard and sharp as axe fall. He couldn't make out the words at first, and paused, searching for their source. The tomb walk was a relic of the old palace cemetery, cut off from the rest of the grounds by the construction of the astronomer's tower. Most of the scholars didn't even know it was there, but the librarians did, because they used it as a shortcut between the stacks and the reading rooms in the base of the tower. That was what Laszlo was doing, his arms full of manuscripts, when he heard the voice. There was a rhythm to it, and an accompanying punctuation of slaps or blows. Thwop, thwop. There was another sound, barely audible. He thought it was an animal, and when he peered around the corner of a mausoleum, he saw an arm rising and falling with the steady, vicious thwop. It wielded a riding crop, and the image was unmistakable. But he still thought it was an animal that was being beaten, because it was low and cringing, and its bitten-off whimpers were no human sound. A burning anger filled him, quick as the strike of a match. He drew in breath to shout, and held it. There was a little light, and in the instant it took his voice to gather up a single word, Laszlo perceived the scene in full. A bowed back, a crouching boy, glaive light on golden hair, and the Duke of Val beating his son like an animal.
"Stop!"
Laszlo had almost said. He held in the word like a mouthful of fire.
"Witless!" Thwop. "Imbecilic!" Thwop. "Lackadaisical!" Thwop. "Pathetic!"
It went on, merciless, and Laszlo flinched with every thwop, his anger smothered by a great confusion. Once he had time to think, it would flare up again, hotter than before. But in the face of such a sight, his overwhelming feeling was shock. He himself was no stranger to punishment. He still had faint scars crisscrossing his legs from all his lashings. He'd sometimes been locked in the crypt overnight, with only the skulls of dead monks for company. And he couldn't even count the number of times he'd been called stupid or worthless or worse. But that was him. He belonged to no one and had nothing. He had never imagined that Thion Nero could be subject to such treatment and such words. He had stumbled upon a private scene that belied everything he thought he knew about the golden godson and his charmed life. And it broke something in him to see the other boy brought low. They weren't friends. That would have been impossible. Nero was an aristocrat, and Laszlo so very much wasn't. But Laszlo had many times fulfilled Thion's research requests, and once, in the early days, when he discovered a rare metallurgical treatise he thought might be of interest, Nero had even said, "Thank you." It might sound like nothing, or worse, it might appall that he only said it once in all those years. But Laszlo knew that boys like him were trained to speak only in commands. And when Thion had looked up from the treatise and spoken those simple words, with gravity and sincerity, "Thank you," he had glowed with pride. Now his "Stop!" sat burning on his tongue. He wanted to shout it, but didn't. He stood rooted, pressed against the cool side of the mossy mausoleum, afraid even to move. The riding crop fell still. Thion cradled his head in his arms, face hidden. He made no more sound, but Laszlo could see his shoulders shaking.
"Get up!"
snarled the Duke. Thion straightened, and Laszlo saw him clearly. His face was slack and red, and his golden hair stuck to his brow in tear-damp strands. He looked a good deal younger than 16.
"Do you know what she spent on your laboratory?"
demanded the Duke.
"Glass blowers all the way from Amaya. A furnace built from your own plans. A smokestack that's the highest point in the entire city. And what have you to show for it all? Notes! Measurements!"
"Alchemy is notes and measurements,"
protested Thion. His voice was thick with tears, but not yet stripped of defiance.
"You have to know the properties of metals before you can hope to alter them."
The Duke shook his head with utter contempt.
"Master Lusinet was right. You do have the soul of a blacksmith. Alchemy is gold. Do you understand me? Gold is your life now, unless you fail to produce it, in which case you'll be lucky to have a life. Do you understand me?"
Thion drew back, stunned by the threat.
"Father, please, it's only been a year."
"Only a year?"
The Duke's laugh was a dead thing.
"Do you know what can happen in a year? Houses fall. Kingdoms fall. While you sit in your laboratory, learning the properties of metal."
This gave Thion pause, and Laszlo too. Kingdoms fall.
"But you can't expect me to do in a year what no one has ever done before."
"No one had ever transmuted metal either. And you did it at 15.
"Only to bismuth,"
the boy said bitterly.
"I am well aware of the inadequacy of your achievement,"
spat the Duke.
"All I've heard from you since you started university is how much smarter you are than everyone else. So be smarter, damn you! I told her you could do it. I assured her.
I'm trying, Father.
Try harder!
This the Duke bellowed. His eyes were very wide, the whites showing in a full ring around his irises. There was desperation in him, and Laszlo, in the shadows, was chilled by it. When the Queen had named the Chrysoposium, he had thought it a fine name for an alchemical laboratory. He'd taken it in the spirit of hope, that the greatest ambition of the art might one day be realized there. But it seemed there was no one day about it. She wanted gold, and she wanted it now. Thion swallowed hard and stared at his father. A wave of fear seemed to roil between them. Slowly, and all but whispering, the boy asked,
"What if it can't be done?"
Laszlo expected the Duke to lash out again, but he only gritted his teeth.
"Let me put it to you plainly. The treasury is empty. The soldiers cannot be paid. They are deserting, and our enemies have noticed. If this goes on, they will invade. Do you begin to see?"
There was more. Disastrous intrigues and debts called in. But what it added up to was very simple. Make gold, or Zosma will fall. Laszlo watched Thion go pale, as the whole weight of the kingdom settled on him, and he felt as though it were on his own shoulders. And it was. Not because it was put there by a cruel father and a greedy queen, but because he took it. Right there in the tomb walk, as though it were a real, physical burden, he put himself beneath it to help Thion bear the weight, even if Thion didn't know it. Why did he? He might have turned aside and gone about his evening and his life, giddy with relief that such burdens weren't his to bear. Most would have. Moreover, most would have hastened hence to whisper of it, and spread the rumor before night finished falling. But Laszlo wasn't most people. He stood in the shadows, furious with thought. He was thinking of war, and the people the last one stole from him before he could know them, and all the children the next one would orphan, and all the names that would die like songs. Through it all, he was highly sensible of his own uselessness. How could he help the Golden Godson? He wasn't an alchemist or a hero. He was a librarian and a dreamer. He was a reader and the unsung expert on a long-lost city no one cared a thing about. What could he possibly... It came to him. He wasn't an alchemist. He was an expert on a long-lost city no one cared a thing about. And it happened that that city, according to its legends, had been practicing alchemy back when Zosma was still a barbarian-plagued wilderness. In fact, the archetypal images of the art and its practitioners came from the old stories brought across the Elmuthaleth. Tales of powerful men and women who had tapped the secrets of nature and the cosmos. Laszlo thought about it. He thought about it as Thion and the Duke left the tomb walk in tense silence, and as he returned his armload of manuscripts to the library, and he kept thinking about it as the library closed for the night, and he missed dinner to return to his room and his books. While resident scholars lived in the grand guest chambers of the palace's upper stories, librarians were housed in the service quarters, one floor above the housekeeping staff, in the rooms once occupied by the ladies' maids and valets. Laszlo entered a long, low-ceilinged passage with many identical doors, each with a glaive hanging on a hook. He took his down and brought it into his room with him. Glaives were quarried stones, naturally and perpetually luminous, and they emitted no heat, only radiance, the color and strength of which varied as greatly as the quality of gemstones. This one was poor, an irregular hunk of reddish rock emitting a muddy glow. Small as the room was, it left the corners in shadow. There was a narrow bed on one side, and a desk and stool on the other. Two wall pegs held every item of clothing Laszlo owned, and there was no shelf but the window ledge. His books were lined up there. He hung up the glaive and started pulling them off and flicking through them. Soon he was sitting on the floor, leaning against the wall, marking pages and jotting down notes. Footsteps passed in the corridor as the other librarians turned in for the night, but Laszlo had no awareness of them, or of the descending silence, or the rise and fall of the moon. Sometime in the night he left his room and made his way down to the dusty sublevel that hadn't been dusty for years. It was his sanctuary, a realm of stories, not just from the unseen city, but the world. Weep might have been his dream, but he loved all stories, and knew every single one that resided here, even if he'd had to translate them from a dozen languages with the help of dictionaries and grammars. Here, captured between covers, was the history of the human imagination, and nothing had ever been more beautiful or fearsome or bizarre. Here were spells and curses and myths and legends, and strange the dreamer had for so long fed his mind on them, that if one could wander into it, they would discover a fantasia. He didn't think like other people. He didn't dismiss magic out of hand, and he didn't believe that fairy tales were just for children. He knew magic was real, because he'd felt it when the name of the unseen city was stolen from his mind. And as for fairy tales, he understood that they were reflections of the people who had spun them, and were flecked with little truths, intrusions of reality into fantasy, like toast crumbs on a wizard's beard. He hoped this might be one such crumb. At the heart of alchemy was the belief in Azoth, the secret essence inherent in all matter. Alchemists believed that if they could distill it, it would enable them to master the underlying structures of the physical world. To transmute lead into gold, derive a universal solvent, and even an elixir of immortality. It had long been accepted that this would be accomplished by means of some elaborate process involving the elemental trinity, salt, mercury, and sulfur. An absurd number of books and treatises had been written on the subject, considering the utter absence of empirical evidence. They were full of diagrams of dragons swallowing suns and men suckling at the breasts of goddesses, and Laszlo thought them as wild as any fairy tales, although they were shelved more respectably in the alchemy room of the library, which, tellingly, had once been the palace treasury. Meanwhile, banished below stairs, where no alchemist would ever look for it, in a book of tales from the unseen city, whimsically titled Miracles for Breakfast, there was mention of another theory, that the alchemist was himself the secret ingredient, that only the conjunction of human soul with elemental soul could give birth to Azoth. And there it was. A crumb on a wizard's beard. Perhaps.
Chapter 5. Miracles for Breakfast.
He ought to have waited, at least for a few days. Really, he ought never to have gone at all. He understood that later. Laszlo understood a lot of things later. Too late. The sun was rising by the time he emerged from the stacks, clutching the book. And he might have been tired from staying up all night, but energy thrummed through him. Excitement. Nerves. He felt as though he were part of something, and forgot that only he knew it. He didn't return to his room, but made his way out of the main palace and across the grounds to the old church that was now the Chrysoposium. All the city was spread out below. A radiance lit the Ada where it met the horizon. As the sun climbed, its gleam raced upriver like a lit fuse, seeming to carry daylight with it. The cathedral bells rang out, and all the other church bells followed, light and sweet, like children answering a parent's call. Laszlo thought Thion might not have slept either, not with the terrible burden laid on him. He approached the doors. They were huge, cast bronze church doors,
and weren't exactly built for knocking. He knocked anyway, but he could hardly hear the rap of his own knuckles. He might have given up then, retreated, and given himself time to think better of what he was about to do. If the initial thrill of discovery had been allowed to wear off, surely he would have seen his folly, even naive as he was. But instead, he checked around the side of the church, found a door with a bell, and rang it. And so things fell out as they did. Thion answered the door. He looked blank, lifeless.
"Well?"
he asked.
"I'm sorry to disturb you,"
Laszlo said, or something to that effect. This part was a blur to him after. His pulse was pounding in his ears. It wasn't like him to put himself forward. If his upbringing at the Abbey had specialized in anything, it was instilling a profound sense of unworthiness. But he was riding the momentum of his outrage on Thion's behalf, and the flush of solidarity from one beaten boy for another, and above all, the thrill of discovery. Maybe he blurted,
"I found something for you,"
and held up the book. Whatever his words, Thion stood back so that he might enter. The space was high and hushed, like any church, but the air stank of sulphur, like a pit of hell. One shafts of dawn light diffused through stained glass, throwing color onto shelves of gleaming glass and copper. The nave was occupied by a long work table, cluttered with equipment. The whole of the apse had been taken over by a monumental furnace, and a brick chimney cut right up through the center of the frescoed dome, obliterating the heads of angels.
"Well, what is it?"
Thion asked. He was moving stiffly, and Laszlo didn't doubt that his back was covered with welts and bruises.
"I suppose you found me another treatise," he said. "They're all worthless, you know." "It's not exactly a treatise."
Laszlo set the book down on the pocked surface of the work table, noticing only now the engraving on the cover. It showed a spoon brimming with stars and mythical beasts. Miracles for Breakfast. It looked like a children's book, and he had his first pang of misgiving. He hurried to open it, to hide the cover and title.
"It is to do with gold, though," he said,
and launched into an explanation. To his dismay, it sounded as out of place in this somber laboratory as the book looked out of place, and he found himself rushing to keep ahead of his growing mortification, which only made it sound wilder and more foolish the faster he went.
"You know the lost city of Weep," he said.
He made himself use the imposter name and immediately tasted tears.
"And its alchemists, who were said to have made gold in ancient times."
"Legends," said Thion, dismissive.
"Maybe," said Laszlo. "But isn't it possible the stories are true? That they made gold?"
He registered the look of incredulity on Thion's face, but misinterpreted it. Thinking it was his premise that the alchemist found unbelievable, he hurried along.
"Look here,"
he said, and pointed to the passage in the book, about the alchemist himself being the secret ingredient of Azoth.
"It says the conjunction of human soul and elemental soul, which sounds, I don't know, unhelpful, because how do you join your soul with metal? But I think it's a mistranslation. I've come across it before. In Unseen, I mean, in the language of Weep, the word for soul and spirit is the same. It's Amarin for both. So I think this is a mistake."
He tapped his finger on the word soul and paused. Here it was, his big idea.
"I think it means that the key to Azoth is spirit. Spirit of the body."
He held out his wrists, pale side up, exposing the traceries of veins so that Thion would be sure to take his meaning. And with that, he found he'd run out of words. A conclusion was needed. Something to shine a light on his idea and make it gleam. But he had none. So it just hung there in the air, sounding, frankly, ridiculous. Thion stared at him several beats too long.
"What
is the meaning of this?
He asked at last, and his voice was ice and danger.
Adair, did you lose a bet? Is it a joke? What?
Startled, Laszlo shook his head. His face went hot and his hands went cold.
No,
he said, seeing Thion's incredulity now for what it was. It wasn't Laszlo's premise he was reacting to. It was his presence. In an instant, Laszlo's perceptions shifted, and he understood what he'd just done. He, Strange the Dreamer, junior librarian, had marched into the Chrysoposium, brandishing a book of fairy tales, and presumed to share his insights on the deepest mystery of alchemy, as though he might solve the problem that had eluded centuries of alchemists, including Nero himself. His own audacity, now that he saw it, took his breath away. How could he have thought this was a good idea?
Tell me the truth, commanded Thion. Who was it? Master Lusine! He sent you here to mock me, didn't he?
Laszlo shook his head to deny the accusation, but he could tell that Thion wasn't even seeing him. He was too lost in his own fury and misery. If he was seeing anything, it was the mocking faces of the other alchemists, or the cool calculations of the queen herself, ordering up miracles like breakfast. Or maybe, probably, he was seeing the scorn on his father's face last night, and feeling it in the rawness of his flesh and the ache of his every movement. There was, in him, such a simmer of emotions, like chemicals thrown together in an alembic. Fear like a sulfur fog, bitterness as sharp as salt, and damned fickle mercury for failure and desperation.
I would never mock you,
Laszlo insisted. Thion grabbed up the book, flipping it closed to study the title and cover.
Miracles for Breakfast,
he intoned, leafing through it. There were pictures of mermaids, witches.
This isn't mockery. I swear it isn't. I may be wrong, my lord. I probably am.
Laszlo saw how it looked, and he wanted to tell what he knew to be true. How folklore was sprinkled with truths. But even that sounded absurd to him now. Crumbs on wizards' beards and all that nonsense.
I'm sorry. It was presumptuous to come here, and I beg your pardon. But I swear to you I meant no disrespect. I only wanted to help you.
Thion snapped the book shut.
To help me? You help me?
He actually laughed. It was a cold, hard sound, like ice shattering. It went on too long, and with every new bite of laughter, Laszlo felt himself grow smaller.
Enlighten me, Strange, said Thion. In what version of the world could you possibly help me?
In what version of the world? Was there more than one? Was there a version where Laszlo grew up with a name and a family, and Thion was put on the cart for the abbey? Laszlo couldn't see it. For all his grand imagination, he couldn't conjure an image of a monk shaving that golden head.
Of course you're right,
he stammered.
I only thought you shouldn't have to bear it all alone.
It was the wrong thing to say.
Bear what all alone?
Asked Thion, query sharp in his eyes. Laszlo saw his mistake. He froze, much as he had in the tomb walk, hiding uselessly in the shadows. There was no hiding here, though. And because there was no guile in him, everything he felt showed on his face. Shock. Outrage. Pity. And finally, Thion understood what had brought this junior librarian to his door in the earliest hours of dawn. If Laszlo had waited, weeks or even days, Thion might not have made the connection so instantly. But his back was on fire with pain, and Laszlo's glance strayed there as though he knew it. Poor Thion, whose father beat him. In an instant, he knew that Laszlo had seen him at his weakest, and the simmer of emotions were joined by one more. It was shame, and it ignited all the others.
"I'm sorry,"
Laszlo said, hardly knowing what he was sorry for, that Thion had been beaten, or that he had chanced to see it.
"Don't you dare pity me, you nothing!"
Thion snarled, with such venom in his voice that Laszlo flinched back as if stung. What followed was a terrible, sickening blur of spite and outrage. A red and twisted face, bared teeth and clenched fists and glass shattering. It all got twisted up in nightmares in the days that followed, and embellished by Laszlo's horror and regret. He stumbled out the door, and maybe a hand gave him a shove, and maybe it didn't. Maybe he just tripped and sprawled down the short flight of steps, biting into his tongue so his mouth filled with blood. And he was swallowing blood, trying to look normal as he made his way, limping, back to the main palace. He reached the steps before he realized he'd left the book behind. No more miracles for breakfast. No breakfast at all. Not today with his bitten tongue swelling in his mouth. And he hadn't eaten dinner the night before, or slept. But he was so far from hungry or tired, and he had some time to collect himself before his shift began. So he did. He bathed his face in cool water, and winced and rinsed his mouth out, spitting red into the basin. His tongue was gristly, the throb and sting seeming to fill his head. He didn't speak a word all day, and no one even noticed. He feared Thion would have him fired, and he was braced for it, but it didn't happen. Nothing happened. No one found out what he'd done that morning. No one missed the book, either, except for him, and he missed it very much. 3 weeks later, he heard the news. The Queen was coming to the Great Library. It was the first time she'd visited since the dedication of the Chrysoposium, which, it would appear, had been a wise investment. Thion Nero had made gold.
Chapter 6 Paper, Ink, and Years.
Coincidence? For hundreds of years, alchemists had been trying to distill azoth. 3 weeks after Laszlo's visit to the Chrysoposium, Thion Nero did it. Laszlo had his suspicions, but they were only suspicions. Until, that is, he opened the door to his room and found Thion in it. Laszlo's pulse stammered. His books were spilled onto the floor, their pages creased beneath them like the broken wings of birds. Thion held one in his hands. It was Laszlo's finest, its binding nearly worthy of the Pavilion of Thought. He'd even illuminated the spine with flakes of leftover gold leaf it took him 3 years to save. "The Unseen City," he'd read, in the calligraphy he'd learned at the Abbey. It hit the floor with a slap, and Laszlo felt it in his hearts. He wanted to stoop and pick it up, but he just stood there on his own threshold and stared at the intruder, so composed, so elegant, and as out of place in the dingy little room as a sunbeam in a cellar.
"Does anyone know that you came to the Chrysoposium?" Thion asked.
Slowly, Laszlo shook his head.
"And the book? Does anybody else know about it?"
And there it was. There was no coincidence. Laszlo had been right. Spirit was the key to azoth. It was almost funny. Not just that the truth had been found in a fairy tale, but that the great secret ingredient should prove so common a thing as a bodily fluid. Every alchemist who had ever lived and died in search of it had had the answer all the time, running through his very veins. If the truth were to be known, anyone with a pot and a fire would try to make gold, drawing spirit from their veins or stealing it from others. It wouldn't be so precious then,
and nor would the golden godson be so special. With that, he understood what was at stake. Thion meant to keep the secret of Azoth at all costs. And Laszlo was a cost. He considered lying, but could think of no lie that might protect him. Hesitant, he shook his head again. And he thought he had never been so aware of anything as he was aware of Thion's hand on the hilt of his sword. Time slowed. He watched Thion's knuckles whiten, saw the span of visible steel lengthen as the sword was drawn up and out of its sheath. It had a curve to it, like a rib. It had a mirror brightness in the glaive light, and caught gold in it, and grey. Laszlo's eyes locked with Thion's. He saw calculation there, as Thion weighed the trouble of killing him with the risk of letting him live. And he knew how that calculus would come out. With him alive, there would always be someone who knew the secret, while killing him would be no trouble at all. Thion might leave his engraved ancestral sword skewered through Laszlo's corpse, and it would be returned to him cleaned. The whole thing would simply be tidied away. Someone like Nero might do as he liked to someone like Laszlo. But he didn't. He sheathed the blade.
"You will never speak of it," he said. "You will never write of it. No one will ever know. Do you understand me?"
"Yes,"
said Laszlo, hoarse.
"Swear to it,"
Thion ordered. But then he cast his eyes over the books on the floor and abruptly changed his mind.
"On second thought, don't swear."
His lips curved into a subtle jeer.
"Promise me 3 times.
Laszlo was startled. A triple promise. It was a child's vow from fairy tales, where breaking it was a curse. And it was more powerful to Laszlo than any vow on god or monarch would have been.
"I promise," he said,
shaking with the chill of his own near death.
"I promise,"
he said again, and his face was hot and burning.
"I promise."
The words, repeated, had the rhythm of an incantation, and they were the last that passed between the 2 young men for more than 4 years. Until the day the golden godson came in person to the inquiry's desk to requisition Laszlo's books. The complete works of Laszlo Strange. Gripping the request form, Laszlo's hands shook. The books were his, and they were all that was his. He'd made them, and he loved them in the way one loves things that come of one's own hands. But even that wasn't the extent of it. They weren't just a collection of notes. They were where he kept his impossible dream. Every discovery he'd made about the unseen city, every piece he'd puzzled into place. And it wasn't for the simple accumulation of knowledge, but with the goal of one day, circumventing impossibility. Of somehow going there, where no outsider had ever been. Of crossing the desert, seeing those glittering domes with his own eyes, and finding out, at last, what happened to the unseen city. His books were a 7-year-long record of his hopes. Even touching them gave him courage. And now they were to fall into Thion Nero's hands.
"What in the world?"
Master Hyrcan had asked.
"Could Thion Nero want with your books?"
"I don't know," said Laszlo, at a loss. "Nothing, only to take them away from me."
The old man clucked his tongue.
"Surely such pettiness is beneath him."
"You think so? Well, then perhaps he intends to read them cover to cover."
Laszlo's tone was flat, and Master Hyrcan took his point. That scenario was indeed the more ridiculous.
"But why?"
Hyrcan persisted.
"Why should he want to take them away from you?"
And Laszlo couldn't tell him that. What he himself was wondering was, why now, 4 years later? He had done nothing to break his promise, or to draw Nero's ire in any way?
Because he can?
He asked, bleak. He fought the requisition. Of course he did. He went straight to the Master of Archives to plead his case. The books were his own, he said, and not property of the library. It had always been made clear that the expertise of librarians was unworthy of the term scholarship. As such, how could they now be claimed? It was contradictory and unjust.
Unjust? You ought to be proud, young man,
Villiers the master told him.
Thion Nero has taken an interest in your work. It's a great day for you.
A great day indeed. For 7 years, Laszlo had been Strange the Dreamer, and his books had been scribblings and foolishness. Now, just like that, they were his work, validated and stolen in one fell swoop.
Please,
he begged, urgent and hushed.
Please don't give him my books.
And they didn't. They made him do it.
You're disgracing yourself,
Villiers snapped.
And I won't have you disgrace the library, too. He's the golden godson, not some thief in the stacks. He'll return them when he's done with them. Now be off with you.
And so he had no choice. He loaded them into a crate and onto a handcart, and trundled them out of the library, through the front gates, and down the long road that spiraled around Zosimos Ridge. He paused and looked out. The Ada sparkled in the sun, the rich brown of a pretty girl's eyes. The new palace arched across it, as fantastical as a painted backdrop in a fairy play. Birds wheeled over the fishing docks, and a long golden pennant flew from the cupola of Nero's pale pink palace. Laszlo made his slow way there, rang the bell with deep reluctance, remembered ringing another bell 4 years earlier, with miracles for breakfast clutched in his hands. He'd never seen it again. Would these books be any different? A butler answered. He bid Laszlo leave the crate, but Laszlo refused.
I must see Lord Nero, he said.
And when Thion at last presented himself, Laszlo asked him simply,
Why?
Why? The alchemist was in his shirt sleeves, without his scarlet cravat. His blade was in its place, though, and his hand rested casually on its hilt.
I've always wanted to ask you that, you know.
Me?
Yes. Why, Strange?
Why did you give it to me?
It.
The secrets and all that followed.
When you might have kept it and been someone yourself.
The truth was, and nothing would have persuaded Nero to believe it, that it had never occurred to Laszlo to seek his own advantage. In the tomb walk that day, it had been very clear to him. Here was a story of greedy queens and wicked fathers and war on the horizon. And it wasn't his story. It was Thion's. To take it for himself, it would have been stealing. It was as simple as that.
I am someone, he said.
He gestured to the crate.
That's who I am.
And then, with quiet intensity,
Don't take them. Please.
There was a moment, very brief, when the guarded dispassion fell away from Thion's face, and Laszlo saw something human in him. Regretful, even. Then it was gone.
Remember your promise,
he warned, and shut the door in Laszlo's face. Laszlo returned to his room late that evening, having lingered at dinner to avoid it. Reaching his door, he took his glaive down off its hook, hesitated, then hung it back up. With a deep breath, he entered. He hoped that darkness might soften the loss, but there was just enough moonlight to bathe his window ledge in a soft glow. Its emptiness was stark. The room felt hollow and dead, like a body with its hearts cut out. Breathing wasn't easy. He dropped onto the edge of his bed.
They're only books, he told himself. Just paper and ink. Paper, ink, and years. Paper, ink, years, and his dream. He shook his head. His dream was in his mind and in his soul. Thion might steal his books, but he couldn't steal that. That was what he told himself that first long night, bereft of his books, and he had trouble falling asleep for wondering where they were and what Nero had done to them. He might have burned them, or put them into a mouldering cellar. He might even now be pulling them apart page by page, folding them into birds, and launching them off his high widow's walk, one by one. When he finally did sleep, Laszlo dreamed his books were buried beneath the earth, and that the blades of grass that grew up from them whispered, "Weep, weep," when the winds blew, and all who heard it felt tears prick their eyes. Never once did he consider that Thion might be reading them, that, in a room as opulent as Laszlo's was plain, with his feet up on a tufted stool and a glaive on either side, he was reading long into the night, while servants brought him tea and supper and tea again. Laszlo certainly never imagined him taking notes, with a swan quill and octopus ink from an inkwell of inlaid lis that had actually come from Weep some 500 years ago. His handsome face was devoid of mockery or malice, and was instead intent, alive, and fascinated. Which was so much worse. Because if Laszlo thought a dream could not be stolen, he underestimated Thion Nero. Chapter 7 Impossible Dream. Without his books, Laszlo felt as though a vital link to his dream had been cut. The unseen city had never seemed more distant or more out of reach. It was as though a fog had lifted, forcing him to confront an uncomfortable truth. His books were not his dream. Moreover, he had tucked his dream into their pages like a bookmark and been content to leave it there for too long. The fact was, nothing he might ever do or read or find inside the great library of Zosma was going to bring him one step closer to Weep. Only a journey would do that. Easier said than done, of course. It was so very far. He might conceivably find a way of reaching Alkenost, the crossroads of the continent and western outpost of the Elmuthaleth. He had no qualifications to recommend him, but there was at least a chance he could hire onto a merchant convoy and work his way there. After that, though, he would be on his own. No guide would take Ferengi across the desert. They wouldn't even sell them camels, so that they might make the attempt on their own, which would be suicide in any case. And even supposing he somehow managed to cross the desert, there would still be the cusp to confront. The mountain of white glass, said in legend to be the funeral pyre of demons. There was only one way over it, and that was through the gates of Fort Mizrach, where Ferengi were executed as spies. If the city was dead, then he might get through to explore its ruins. The thought was unutterably sad. He didn't want to find ruins, but a city full of life and color, like the one from the stories. But if the city was alive, then he could expect to be drawn and quartered and fed in pieces to the carrion birds. It wasn't hard to see why he'd tucked his dream into his books for safekeeping. But now it was all he had left, and he had to take a good, hard look at it. It wasn't encouraging. Whatever way he turned it, all he saw was impossible. If the dream chose the dreamer, then his had chosen poorly. It needed someone far more daring than he. It needed the thunder and the avalanche, the war cry and the whirlwind. It needed fire. It was a low point, the weeks after Thion Nero took away his books. The days dragged, the walls closed in. He dreamed of deserts and great empty cities, and imagined he could feel the minutes and hours of his life running through them,
as though he were nothing but an hourglass of flesh and bone. He found himself staring out windows, wistful, yearning for that distant, unattainable horizon. Which is how he happened to see the bird. He was up one of the ladders in the Pavilion of Thought, pulling books for an impatient philosopher who paced below.
"I haven't got all day,"
the man called up. "I have," thought Laszlo, pushing off to send his ladder rolling along its tracks. He was at the top tier of the very tall shelves, along the northern wall beyond which the shark fin ridge fell away in a sheer cliff, all the way to the city. There were narrow windows slotted between each section of bookcase, and he caught glimpses of the summer sky as he rolled past them. Bookcase, window, bookcase, window. And there it was, a bird, hovering on an updraft, as birds like to do on this side of the ridge, hanging in place like tethered kites. But he'd never seen a bird like this one. He halted the ladder to watch it, and something went very still at the core of him. It was pure white, a hook-beaked raptor, and it was immense, larger even than the hunting eagles he'd seen with the nomads who passed through the marketplace. Its wings were like the sails of a small ship, each feather as broad as a cutlass. But it wasn't just its color or size that struck him. There was something about it. Some trick of the light? Its edges. They weren't defined, but seemed to melt against the blue of the sky like sugar dissolving into tea. Like a ghost diffusing through the veil of the world.
"What are you doing up there?"
called the philosopher. Laszlo ignored him. He leaned forward to peer through the glare on the glass. The bird pirouetted on one vast wing and tipped into a slow, graceful spiral. He watched it plummet and soar out to cast its shadow over the roadway below and over the roof of a carriage. The royal carriage. Laszlo's forehead clashed against the window in his surprise. There was a procession coming up the long, winding road. Not just the carriage, but files of mounted soldiers, both ahead and behind, the sun glittering on their armor. He squinted. One troop of soldiers didn't look like the others, but they were too distant for a clear view. Their armor didn't glitter. Their mounts moved with a strange gait. The road curved around to the ridge's south face, and soon the whole procession had passed out of view. The huge white eagle glided after them, and then... Perhaps Laszlo looked away. Perhaps he blinked. He didn't think so. But just like that, the bird wasn't there anymore. It was, and then it wasn't. And even if he had blinked, it couldn't have left his sight so quickly. There was no cover nearby, nothing to hide it. The drumbeat of Laszlo's blood and spirit surged. The bird had vanished.
"You there!"
The philosopher was getting angry. Laszlo looked down at him.
"Is the queen meant to visit today?"
he called.
"What? No! Because the royal carriage is coming!"
The scholars sitting nearest heard and looked up. Word spread in murmurs. Royal visits were rare, and generally announced well in advance. Soon the scholars were standing up from their tables and leaving their materials behind to go outside and gather in the entrance court. Laszlo descended the ladder and walked out with them, not even hearing the call of his name from the librarian behind the inquiries desk.
"Strange! Where are you going? Strange!"
The bird had vanished. It was magic. Laszlo knew it, as he'd known before. Whatever had happened to the city's true name, magic was responsible. Laszlo had never doubted it, but he'd feared that he'd never see further proof of it. He had a trio of fears that sat in his gut like swallowed teeth, and when he was too quiet with his own thoughts, they'd grind together to gnaw at him from within. This was the first, that he would never see further proof of magic. The second, that he would never find out what had happened in Weep. The third, that he would always be as alone as he was now. All his life, Time had been passing in the only way he knew time to pass. Unrushed and unrushable. As sands running through an hourglass, grain by grain. And if the hourglass had been real, then in the bottom and neck, the past and the present, the sands of Laszlo's life would be as grey as his robes.